children's hair turned white. He was cutting things like a guy with a machete blasting his way through the jungle. Down in Pensacola, he was sticking it to the Coast Guard. They'd been running an initiative for the last 12 months. They'd been out in force, like a curved shield off Florida's coast every day for a year, boarding and searching all the marine traffic they didn't like the smell of. It had been announced with an enormous fanfare, and it had been successful beyond their wildest dreams. They had seized all kinds of stuff, drugs mostly, but guns as well, illegal migrants from Haiti and Cuba. The interdiction was reducing crime all over the states months later and thousands of miles further down the line. A big success. So, it was being abandoned. It was very expensive to run. The Coast Guard's budget was in too serious deficit. The president said he couldn't increase it. In fact, he'd have to cut it. The economy was in a mess. Nothing else he could do. So the interdiction initiative would be canceled in 7 days' time. The president was trying to come across like a statesman. Law enforcement big shots were angry because they figured prevention was better than cure. Washington insiders were happy because 50 cents spent on beat cops was much more visible than $2 spent out on the ocean 2,000 miles away from the voters. The arguments flew back and forth, and in the smudgy photographs, the president was just beaming away like a statesman, saying there was nothing he could do. I stopped reading because it was just making me angrier. To calm down, I ran music through my head. The chorus in Smokestack Lightning. The Howling Wolf version puts a wonderful strangled cry on the end of the first line. They say you need to ride the rails for a while to understand the traveling blues. They're wrong. To understand the traveling blues, you need to be locked down somewhere. In a cell. Or in the army. Someplace where you're caged. Someplace where smokestack lightning looks like a faraway beacon of impossible freedom. I lay there with my coat as a pillow and listened to the music in my head. At the end of the third chorus, I fell asleep. I woke up again when Baker started kicking the bars. They made a dull, ringing sound like a funeral bell. Baker stood there with Finley. They looked down at me. I stayed on the floor. I was comfortable down there. "Where did you say you were at midnight last night?" Finley asked me. "Getting on the bus in Tampa," I said. "We've got a new witness," Finley said. "He saw you at the warehouse facility last night, hanging around at midnight." "Total crap, Finley," I said. "Impossible. Who the hell is this new witness?" "The witness is Chief Morrison," Finley said. "The chief of police. He says he was sure he had seen you before. Now, he has remembered where." 3. They took me back to the Rosewood office in handcuffs. Finley sat at the big desk in front of the flags under the old clock. Baker set a chair at the end of the desk. I sat opposite Finley. He took out the tape machine, dragged out the cords, positioned the microphone between us, tested it with his fingernail, rolled the tape back. "Ready." "The last 24 hours, Reacher," he said. "In detail?" The two policemen were crackling with repressed excitement. A weak case had suddenly grown strong. The thrill of winning was beginning to grip them. I recognized the signs. "I was in Tampa last night," I said. "Got on the bus at midnight. Witnesses can confirm that." I got off the bus at 8 this morning, where the county road meets the highway. If Chief Morrison says he saw me at midnight, he's mistaken. At that time, I was about 400 miles away. I can't add anything more. Check it out. Finlay stared at me. Then he nodded to Baker, who opened a buff file. "Victim is unidentified," Baker said. "No ID, no wallet, no distinguishing marks. White, male, maybe 40. Very tall, shaved head. Body was found up there at 8 this morning on the ground against the perimeter fence close to the main gate. It was partially covered with cardboard. We were able to fingerprint the body. Negative result. No match anywhere in the database." "Who was he, Reacher?" Finlay asked. Baker waited for some sort of reaction from me. He didn't get one. I just sat there and listened to the quiet tick of the old clock. The hands crawled around to 2:30. I didn't speak. Baker riffed through the file and selected another sheet. He glanced up again and continued. "Victim received 2 shots to the head," he said. "Probably a small-caliber automatic with a silencer. First shot was close range, left temple. Second was a contact shot behind the left ear. Obviously soft-nosed slugs because the exit wounds removed the guy's face. Rain has washed away the powder deposits, but the burn pattern suggests the silencer. Fatal shot must have been the first. No bullets remained in the skull. No shell cases were found."
"Where's the gun, Reacher?" Finlay said.
I looked at him and made a face. Didn't speak.
"Victim died between 11:30 and 1 o'clock last night," Baker said. "Body wasn't there at 11:30 when the evening gate man went off duty. He confirms that. It was found when the day man came in to open the gate, about 8 o'clock. He saw you leaving the scene and phoned it in."
"Who was he, Reacher?"
Finlay said again. I ignored him and looked at Baker.
"Why before 1 o'clock?" I asked him.
"The heavy rain last night began at 1 o'clock," he said. "The pavement underneath the body was bone dry, so the body was on the ground before 1 o'clock when the rain started. Medical opinion is he was shot at midnight."
I nodded. Smiled at them. The time of death was going to let me out.
"Tell us what happened next," Finlay said quietly.
I shrugged at him.
"You tell me," I said.
"I wasn't there. I was in Tampa at midnight."
Baker leaned forward and pulled another sheet out of the file.
"What happened next is you got weird," he said.
"You went crazy."
I shook my head at him.
"I wasn't there at midnight," I said again. "I was getting on the bus in Tampa. Nothing too weird about that."
The two cops didn't react. They looked pretty grim.
"Your first shot killed him," Baker said. "Then you shot him again. And then you went berserk and kicked the shit out of the body. There are massive post-mortem injuries. You shot him, and then you tried to kick him apart. You kicked that corpse all over the damn place. You were in a frenzy. Then you calmed down and tried to hide the body under the cardboard."
I was quiet for a long moment.
"Post-mortem injuries?" I said.
Baker nodded.
"Like a frenzy," he said.
"The guy looks like he was run over by a truck. Just about every bone is smashed. But the doctor says it happened after the guy was already dead."
"You're a weird guy, Reacher. That's for damn sure."
"Who was he?" Finlay asked for the third time.
I just looked at him.
Baker was right. It had got weird. Very weird. Homicidal frenzy is bad enough, But post-mortem frenzy is worse. I'd come across it a few times. Didn't want to come across it anymore. But the way they had described it to me, it didn't make any sense.
How did you meet the guy? Finley asked.
I carried on just looking at him. Didn't answer.
What does pluribus mean?
He asked. I shrugged, kept quiet.
Who was he, Reacher?
Finley asked again.
I wasn't there, I said. I don't know anything.
Finley was silent.
What's your phone number?
He said, suddenly. I looked at him like he was crazy.
Finley, what the hell are you talking about?
I said. I haven't got a phone. Don't you listen? I don't live anywhere.
I mean your mobile phone, he said.
What mobile phone? I said. I haven't got a mobile phone. A clang of fear hit me. They figured me for an assassin. A weird, rootless mercenary with a mobile phone who went from place to place killing people, kicking their dead bodies to pieces, checking in with an underground organization for my next target, always on the move. Finley leaned forward. He slid a piece of paper toward me. It was a torn-off section of computer paper. Not old. A greasy gloss of wear on it. The patina paper gets from a month in a pocket. On it was printed an underlined heading. It said, Pluribus. Under the heading was a telephone number. I looked at it. Didn't touch it. Didn't want any confusion over fingerprints.
Is that your number? Finley asked.
I don't have a telephone, I said again. I wasn't here last night. The more you hassle me, the more time you're wasting, Finley.
It's a mobile phone number, he said. That we know.
Operated by an Atlanta airtime supplier. But we can't trace the number until Monday. So we're asking you.
You should cooperate, Reacher.
I looked at the scrap of paper again.
Where was this? I asked him.
Finley considered the question, decided to answer it.
It was in your victim's shoe, he said. Folded up and hidden.
I sat in silence for a long time. I was worried. I felt like somebody in a kid's book who falls down a hole, finds himself in a strange world where everything is different and weird, like Alice in Wonderland. Did she fall down a hole? Or did she get off a greyhound in the wrong place? I was in a plush and opulent office. I had seen worse offices in Swiss banks. I was in the company of two policemen, intelligent and professional, probably had more than 30 years' experience between them. A mature and competent department, properly staffed and well-funded. A weak point, with the asshole Morrison at the top, but as good an organization as I had seen for a while. But they were all disappearing up a dead end as fast as they could run. They seemed convinced the earth was flat, that the huge Georgia sky was a bowl fitting snugly over the top. I was the only one who knew the earth was round.
Two things, I said.
The guy is shot in the head close up with a silenced automatic weapon. First shot drops him. Second shot is insurance. The shell cases are missing. What does that say to you? Professionally. Finlay said nothing. His prime suspect was discussing the case with him like a colleague. As the investigator, he shouldn't allow that. He should cut me down. But he wanted to hear me out. I could see him arguing with himself. He was totally still, but his mind was struggling like kittens in a sack.
Go on, he said eventually.
gravely, like it was a big deal.
That's an execution, Finley, I said. Not a robbery or a squabble. That's a cold and clinical hit. No evidence left behind. That's a smart guy with a flashlight scrabbling around afterward for two small caliber shell cases.
Go on, Finley said again.
Close range shot into the left temple, I said. Could be the victim was in a car. Shooter is talking to him through the window and raises his gun. Bang. He leans in and fires the second shot. Then he picks up his shell cases and he leaves.
He leaves? Finley said. What about the rest of the stuff that went down? You're suggesting a second man?
I shook my head. There were three men, I said.
That's clear, right?
Why three? He said.
Practical minimum of two, right? I said. How did the victim get out there to the warehouses?
He drove, right? Too far from anywhere to walk. So, where's his car now?
The shooter didn't walk there either. So the practical minimum would be a team of two. They drove up there together and they drove away separately, one of them in the victim's car.
But, Finley said,
but the actual evidence points to a minimum of three, I said. Think about it psychologically. That's the key to this thing. A guy who uses a silenced small-caliber automatic for a neat headshot and an insurance shot is not the type of guy who then suddenly goes berserk and kicks the shit out of a corpse, right? And the type of guy who does get in a frenzy like that doesn't then suddenly calm down and hide the body under some old cardboard. You're looking at three completely separate things there, Finley. So there were three guys involved. Finley shrugged at me.
Two. Maybe, he said. Shooter could have tidied up afterward.
No way, I said. He wouldn't have waited around. He wouldn't like that kind of frenzy. It would embarrass him. And it would worry him because it adds visibility and danger to the whole thing. And a guy like that, if he had tidied up afterward, he'd have done it right. He wouldn't have left the body where the first guy who came along was going to find it. So you're looking at three guys. Finley thought hard.
So, he said.
So, which one am I supposed to be? I said. The shooter? The maniac? Or the idiot who hid the body? Finley and Baker looked at each other, didn't answer me.
So, whichever one, what are you saying? I asked them.
I drive up there with my two buddies, and we hit the sky at midnight, and then my two buddies drive away, and I choose to stay there? Why would I do that?
It's crap, Finley.
He didn't reply. He was thinking. I haven't got two buddies, I said, or a car. So the very best you can do is to say the victim walked there, and I walked there. I met him, and I very carefully shot him, like a pro, then recovered my shell cases and took his wallet and emptied his pockets, but forgot to search his shoes. Then I stashed my weapon, silencer, flashlight, mobile phone, the shell cases, the wallet, and all. Then I completely changed my whole personality and kicked the corpse to pieces like a maniac. Then I completely changed my whole personality again and made a useless attempt to hide the body. And then I waited 8 hours in the rain, and then I walked down into town. That's the very best you can do. And it's total crap, Finley, because why the hell would I wait 8 hours in the rain
until daylight to walk away from a homicide. He looked at me for a long moment.
I don't know why, he said.
A guy like Finley doesn't say a thing like that unless he's struggling. He looked deflated. His case was crap, and he knew it. But he had a severe problem with the chief's new evidence. He couldn't walk up to his boss and say, "You're full of shit, Morrison." He couldn't actively pursue an alternative when his boss had handed him a suspect on a plate. He could follow up my alibi. That he could do. Nobody would criticize him for being thorough. Then he could start again on Monday. So he was miserable because 72 hours were going to get wasted, and he could foresee a big problem. He had to tell his boss that, actually, I could not have been there at midnight. He would have to politely coax a retraction out of the guy. Difficult to do when you're a new subordinate who's been there 6 months. And when the person you're dealing with is a complete asshole, and your boss, difficulties were all over him, and the guy was miserable as hell about it. He sat there breathing hard, in trouble. Time to help him out. The phone number, I said. You've identified it as a mobile? By the code, he said. Instead of an area code, they have a prefix which accesses the mobile network. Okay, I said. But you can't identify who it belongs to because you have no reverse directories for mobiles, and their office won't tell you, right? They want a warrant, he said. But you need to know whose number it is, right? I said. You know some way of doing that without a warrant? He asked. Maybe, I said. Why don't you just call it up and see who answers? They hadn't thought of that. There was another silence. They were embarrassed. They didn't want to look at each other. Or me. Silence. Baker bailed out of the situation, left Finley holding the ball. He collected the files and mimed going outside to work on them. Finley nodded and waved him away. Baker got up and went out, closed the door very quietly indeed. Finley opened his mouth and closed it. He needed to save some face. Badly.
It's a mobile, he said. If I call it up, I can't tell whose it is or where it is.
Listen, Finley, I said. I don't care whose it is. All I care is whose it isn't. Understand? It isn't my phone. So you call it up, and John Doe in Atlanta or Jane Doe in Charleston answers it. Then you know it isn't mine.
Finley gazed at me, drummed his fingers on the desk, kept quiet.
You know how to do this, I said. Call the numbers, some bullshit story about a technical fault or an unpaid bill, some computer thing. Get the person to confirm name and address.
Do it, Finley. You're supposed to be a damn detective.
He leaned forward to where he had left the number, slid the paper back with his long brown fingers, reversed it so he could read it, and picked up the phone. Dialed the number. Hit the speakerphone button. The ringtone filled the air. Not a sonorous, long tone like a home phone. A high, urgent, electronic sound. It stopped. The phone was answered.
Paul Hubble, a voice said. How may I help you?
A southern accent, a confident manner, accustomed to telephones.
Mr. Hubble,
Finley said. He was looking at the desk, writing down the name.
Good afternoon. This is the phone company, mobile division, engineering manager. We've had a fault reported on your number.
A fault? The voice said. Seems okay to me.
I didn't report a fault. Calling out should be okay, Finley said. It's reaching you that may have been a problem, sir. I've got our signal strength meter connected right now, and actually, sir, it's reading a bit low.
I can hear you okay, the voice said.
Hello? Finley said.
You're fading a bit, Mr. Hubble.
Hello?
It would help me to know the exact geographic location of your phone, sir. You know, right now, in relation to our transmitting stations.
I'm right here at home, said the voice.
Okay, Finley said. He picked up his pen again. Could you just confirm that exact address for me?
Don't you have my address? The voice said.
Man to man. Jocular stuff.
You seem to manage to send me a bill every month.
Finley glanced at me. I was smiling at him. He made a face.
I'm here in engineering right now, sir, he said.
Also jocular. Just two regular guys battling technology.
Customer details are in a different department. I could access that data, but it would take a minute. You know how it is.
Also, sir, you've got to keep talking anyway while this meter is connected to give me an exact strength reading, you know?
You may as well recite your address, unless you've got a favorite poem or anything.
The tinny speakerphone relayed a laugh from the guy called Hubble.
Okay, here goes. Testing, testing, his voice said. This is Paul Hubble, right here at home. That's number 25 Beckman Drive. I say again, 025 Beckman Drive. Down here in little old Margrave, that's M-A-R-G-R-A-V-E, in the state of Georgia, USA.
How am I doing on my signal strength? Finley didn't respond. He was looking very worried.
Hello? The voice said. Are you still there?
Yes, Mr. Hubble, Finley said. I'm right here.
Can't find any problem at all, sir. Just a false alarm, I guess. Thank you for your help.
Okay, said the guy called Hubble.
You're welcome.
The connection broke and a dial tone filled the room. Finley replaced the phone, leaned back and looked up at the ceiling, spoke to himself.
Shit, he said. Right here in town. Who the hell is this Paul Hubble?
You don't know the guy? I said. He looked at me, a bit rueful, like he had forgotten I was there.
I've only been here 6 months, he said. I don't know everybody.
He leaned forward and buzzed the intercom button on the rosewood desk, called Baker back in.
Ever heard of some guy called Hubble? Finley asked him. Paul Hubble lives here in town, 25 Beckman Drive.
Paul Hubble? Baker said.
Sure. He lives here. Like you say, always has. Family man. Stevenson knows him, some kind of an in-law or something. They're friendly, I think. Go bowling together. Hubble's a banker. Some kind of a financial guy, you know, a big-shot executive type. Works up in Atlanta. Some big bank up there. I see him around, time to time.
Finley looked at him. He's the guy on the other end of this number, he said.
Hubble? Baker said. Right here in Margrave?
That's a hell of a thing.
Finley turned back to me.
I suppose you're going to say you never heard of this guy, he asked me.
Never heard of him, I said. He glared at me briefly, turned back to Baker.
You better go on out and bring this Hubble guy in, he said. 25 Beckman Drive. God knows what he's got to do with anything, but we better talk to him.
Go easy on him, you know. He's probably a respectable guy. He glared at me again and left the room, banged the heavy door. Baker reached over and stopped the recording machine, walked me out of the office back to the cell. I went in. He followed and removed the handcuffs, put them back on his belt, stepped back out and closed the gate, operated the lock. The electric bolts snicked home. He walked away.
"Hey, Baker," I called.
He turned and walked back, a level gaze, not friendly. "I want something to eat," I said, "and coffee."
"You eat up at the state facility," he said. "Bus comes by at 6.
He walked away. He had to go and fetch the Hubble guy. He would shuffle up to him apologetically, ask him to come down to the station house, where Finley would be polite to him. While I stood in a cell, Finley would politely ask Hubble why his phone number had been found in a dead man's shoe. My coat was still balled up on the cell floor. I shook it out and put it on. I was cold again. Thrust my hands into the pockets, leaned on the bars and tried to read through the newspaper again just to pass the time. But I wasn't taking anything in. I was thinking about somebody who had watched his partner shoot a guy in the head, who had seized the twitching body and kicked it around the floor, who had used enough furious force to smash all the dead inert bones. I was standing there thinking about stuff I'd thought I was through with. Stuff I didn't want to think about anymore. So I dropped the paper on the carpet and tried to think about something else. I found that if I leaned up in the front far corner of the cell, I could see the whole of the open plan area. I could see over the reception counter and out through the glass doors. Outside, the afternoon sun looked bright and hot. It looked like a dry and dusty place again. The heavy rain had moved on out. Inside was cool and fluorescent. The desk sergeant sat up on a stool. He worked on his keyboard, probably filing. I could see behind his counter. Underneath were spaces designed not to be seen from the front. Neat compartments contained papers and hardback folders. There were sections with mace sprays, a shotgun, panic buttons. Behind the desk sergeant, the uniformed woman who had printed me was busy. Keyboard work. The large room was quiet, but it hummed with the energy of investigation. 4. People spend thousands of dollars on stereos, sometimes tens of thousands. There is a specialist industry right here in the States which builds stereo gear to a standard you wouldn't believe. Tubed amplifiers which cost more than a house. Speakers taller than me. Cables thicker than a garden hose. Some army guys had that stuff. I'd heard it on bases around the world. Wonderful. But they were wasting their money, because the best stereo in the world is free, inside your head. It sounds as good as you want it to, as loud as you want it to be. I was leaning up in my corner, running a Bobby Bland number through my head, an old favorite. It was cranked up real loud. "Further on up the road," Bobby Bland sings it in G major. That key gives it a strange, sunny, cheerful cast. Takes out the spiteful sting from the lyric. Makes it a lament, a prediction, a consolation. Makes it do what the blues is supposed to do. The relaxed G major misting it almost into sweetness. Not vicious. But then I saw the fat police chief walk by. Morrison, on his way past the cells, toward the big office and back. Just in time for the start of the third verse. I crunched the song down into E-flat, a dark and menacing key, the real blues key. I deleted the amiable Bobby Bland. I needed a harder voice, something much more vicious, musical, but a real cigarettes and whiskey rasp. Maybe Wild Child Butler, someone you wouldn't want to mess with. I wound the level in my head up higher, for the part about reaping what you sow, further on up the road. Morrison was lying about last night. I hadn't been there at midnight. For a while, I had been prepared to accept the possibility of a mistake. Maybe he had seen someone who looked like me. But that was giving him the benefit of the doubt. Right now, I wanted to give him a forearm smash to the face, burst his fat nose all over the place. I closed my eyes. Wild Child Butler and I promised ourselves it would happen. Further on, up the road. I opened my eyes and switched off the music in my head. Standing in front of me on the other side of the bars was the fingerprint officer. She was on her way back from the coffee hot plate.
"Can I get you a cup of coffee?"
she asked me.
"Sure," I said. "Great. No cream, no sugar."
She put her own cup down on the nearest desk and went back to the machine, poured me a cup from the pot and walked back. This was a good-looking woman, about 30. Dark, not tall. But to call her medium would be unfair to her. She had a kind of vitality. It had come across as a sympathetic briskness in that first interview room, a professional bustle. Now she seemed unofficial. Probably was. Probably against the fat chief's rules to bring coffee to the condemned man. It made me like her. She passed the cup in through the bars. Up close, she looked good. Smelled good. I didn't recall that from earlier. I remembered thinking of her like a dentist's nurse. If dentist's nurses all looked that good, I'd have gone more often. I took the cup. I was glad of it. I was thirsty, and I love coffee. Give me the chance, and I drink coffee like an alcoholic drinks vodka. I took a sip. Good coffee. I raised the cup like a toast. "Thank you," I said.
"You're welcome,"
she said, and she smiled. With her eyes, too. I smiled back. Her eyes were like a welcome blast of sunshine on a rotten afternoon.
"So you think I didn't do it?"
I asked her. She picked up her own cup from where she had put it down.
"You think I don't bring coffee to the guilty ones?"
she said.
"Maybe you don't even talk to the guilty ones," I said.
"I know you're not guilty of much,"
she said.
"How can you tell?" I said. "Because my eyes aren't too close together?"
"No, fool,"
she laughed.
"Because we haven't heard from Washington yet."
Her laugh was great. I wanted to look at her nameplate over her shirt pocket, but I didn't want her to think I was looking at her breasts. I remembered them resting on the edge of the table when she took my photograph. I looked. Nice breasts. Her name was Roscoe. She glanced around quickly and moved closer to the bars. I sipped coffee.
"I sent your prints to Washington over the computer link," she said. "That was at 1236. Big database there, you know, FBI. Millions of prints in their computer. Prints that get sent in are checked. There's a priority order. You get checked, first of all, against the top 10 wanted list, then the top 100, then the top 1,000. You understand? If you'd been near the top, you know, active and unsolved, we'd have heard almost right away. It's automatic. They don't want any big fugitive to slip away, so the system gets right back. But you've been in there almost 3 hours, and we haven't heard, so I can tell you're not on record for anything very bad.
The desk sergeant was looking over, disapproving. She was going to have to go. I drained the coffee and handed her the cup back through the bars. I'm not on record for anything at all, I said.
No, she said. You don't match the deviant's profile.
I don't, I said.
I could tell right away, she smiled. You got nice eyes.
She winked and walked away, trashed the cups and moved over to her workstation. She sat down. All I could see was the back of her head. I moved into my corner and leaned up against the hard bars. I'd been a lonely wanderer for 6 months. I had learned something. Like Blanche in that old movie, a wanderer depends on the kindness of strangers. Not for anything specific or material, for morale. I gazed at the back of Roscoe's head and smiled.
I liked her.
Baker had been gone maybe 20 minutes, long enough to get back from Hubble's place, wherever it was. I figured you could walk there and back in 20 minutes. This was a small town, right? A dot on the map. I figured you could walk anywhere and back in 20 minutes. On your hands. Although the town limits were pretty weird. Depended whether Hubble lived in town or somewhere else within the outer boundaries. According to my experience, you were in town even when you were 14 miles away. If that 14 miles extended in all directions, then Margrave was about as big as New York City. Baker had said Hubble was a family man, a banker who worked in Atlanta. That meant a family house somewhere near town, near schools and friends for the kids, near shops and the country club for the wife, an easy drive for him up the county road to the highway, convenient commute up the highway to the office in the big city. The address sounded like a town address, 25 Beckman Drive, not too close to Main Street. Probably Beckman Drive ran from the center of town out into the countryside. Hubble was a financial guy, probably rich, probably had a big white place on a big lot, shade trees, maybe a pool. Call it 4 acres. A square lot covering 4 acres was about 140 yards on his side. Homes on the left and the right of this street put number 25 about 12 lots out from town. About a mile, maybe. Outside the big plate glass doors, the sun was falling away into afternoon. The light was redder. Shadows were longer. I saw Baker's patrol car yaw and bounce into the driveway. No flashing lights. It came slowly around the semicircle and eased to a stop. Bounced once on its springs. Its length filled the view through the plate glass. Baker got out on the far side and walked out of sight as he rounded the car. He reappeared as he approached his passenger's door. He opened it like the chauffeur. He looked all twisted up with conflicting body language, part deferential because this was an Atlanta banker, part friendly because this was his partner's bowling buddy, part official because this was a man whose phone number had been hidden in a corpse's shoe. Paul Hubble got out of the car. Baker shut the door. Hubble waited. Baker skipped around him and pulled open the big plate glass door of the station house. It sucked against the rubber seal. Hubble stepped inside. He was a tall white man. He looked like a page from a magazine, an advertisement, the sort that uses a grainy photograph of money at play. He was in his early 30s, trim but not strong, sandy hair, tousled, receding just enough to show an intelligent brow, just enough to say,
Yes, I was a preppy, but hey, I'm a man now. He wore gold-rimmed round eyeglasses. He had a square jaw, a decent tan, very white teeth. Many of them were on show as he smiled at the desk sergeant. He wore a faded polo shirt with a small logo and washed chino pants, the sort of clothes that look old when you buy them for $500. He had a thick white sweater draped over his back. The arms were loosely tied in front. I couldn't see his feet because the reception desk was in the way. I was certain he would be wearing tan boat shoes. I made a substantial bet with myself he was wearing them without socks. This was a man who wallowed in the yuppie dream like a pig in shit. He was in a state of some agitation. He placed his palms on the reception desk and then turned and dropped his hands to his sides. I saw sandy forearms and the flash of a heavy gold watch. I could see his natural approach would be to act like a friendly rich guy, visiting the station house like our campaigning president would visit a factory. But he was distracted, uptight. I didn't know what Baker had said to him, how much he had revealed. Probably nothing. A good sergeant like Baker would leave the bombshells to Finley. So Hubble didn't know why he was here. But he knew something. I was a policeman of sorts for 13 years, and I can smell a worried man a mile away. Hubble was a worried man. I stayed leaning up on the bars, motionless. Baker signaled Hubble to walk with him around the far side of the squad room, toward the Rosewood office in back. As Hubble rounded the end of the reception desk, I saw his feet. Tan boat shoes, no socks. The two men walked out of sight into the office. The door closed. The desk sergeant left his post and went outside to park Baker's cruiser. He came back in with Finlay at his side. Finlay walked straight back toward the Rosewood office where Hubble waited for him, ignored me as he crossed the squad room, opened the office door and went inside. I waited in my corner for Baker to come out. Baker couldn't stay in there, not while his partner's bowling buddy entered the orbit of a homicide investigation. That would not be ethical. Not ethical at all. Finley struck me as a guy who would go big on ethics. Any guy with a tweed suit like that and a moleskin vest and a Harvard education would go big on ethics. After a moment, the door opened and Baker came out. He walked into the big open room and headed for his desk. "Hey, Baker," I called. He changed course and walked over to the cells, stood in front of the bars where Roscoe had stood. "I need to go to the bathroom," I said. "Unless I gotta wait until I get up to the big house for that, too." He cracked a grin. Grudging, but a grin. He had a gold tooth way back. Gave him a rakish air. A bit more human. He shouted something to the desk guy. Probably a code for a procedure. He took out his keys and activated the electric lock. The bolts popped back. I wondered briefly how they did it if there was a power outage. Could they unlock these gates without electricity? I hoped so. Probably lots of thunderstorms down here. Lots of power lines crashing down. He pushed the heavy gate inward. We walked to the back of the squad room, opposite corner to the Rosewood office. There was a lobby. Off the lobby were two bathrooms. He reached past me and pushed open the men's room door. They knew I wasn't their guy. They weren't taking care. No care at all. Out there in the lobby, I could have decked Baker and taken his revolver. No problem at all. I could have had his weapon off his belt before he hit the floor. I could have shot my way out of the station house and into a patrol car. They were all parked right out front. Keys in, for sure. I could have got out toward Atlanta before they organized effective opposition. Then I could have disappeared. No problem at all. but I just went into their bathroom. Don't lock it, Baker said. I didn't lock it. They were underestimating me in a big way. I had told them I had been a military policeman. Maybe they believed me, maybe they didn't. Maybe it didn't mean much to them either way. But it should. A military policeman deals with military lawbreakers. Those lawbreakers are service guys, highly trained in weapons, sabotage, unarmed combat. Rangers, Green Berets, Marines. Not just killers, trained killers. Extremely well trained, at huge public expense. So the military policeman is trained even better. Better with weapons. Better unarmed. Baker had to be ignorant of all that. Hadn't thought about it. Otherwise, he would have had a couple of shotguns aimed at me for the trip to the bathroom. If he thought I was their guy. I zipped up and came back into the lobby. Baker was waiting. We walked back to the cell area. I stepped inside my cell, leaned up in my corner. Baker pulled the heavy gate shut, operated the electric lock with his key. The bolts snicked in. He walked away into the squad room. There was silence for the next 20 minutes. Baker worked at a desk. So did Roscoe. The desk sergeant sat up on his stool. Finlay was in the big office with Hubble. There was a modern clock over the front doors. Not as elegant as the antique in the office, but it ticked around just as slowly. Silence. 4:30. I leaned up against the titanium bars and waited. Silence. 4:45. Time restarted just before 5 o'clock. I heard a commotion coming out of the big Rosewood office in back. Shouting. Yelling. Things banging. Somebody getting really stirred up. A buzzer sounded on Baker's desk, and the intercom crackled. I heard Finlay's voice, stressed, asking Baker to get in there. Baker got up and walked over, knocked and went in. The big plate glass door at the entrance sucked open, and the fat guy came in. Chief Morrison. He headed straight back to the Rosewood office. Baker came out as Morrison went in. Baker hurried over to the reception desk, whispered a long, excited sentence to the desk sergeant. Roscoe joined them. There was a huddle. Some big news. I couldn't hear what. Too far away. The intercom on Baker's desk crackled again. He headed back to the office. The big front door opened again. The afternoon sun was blazing low in the sky. Stevenson walked into the station house. First time I'd seen him since my arrest. It was like the excitement was sucking people in. Stevenson spoke to the desk sergeant. He became agitated. The desk sergeant put a hand on Stevenson's arm. Stevenson shook it off and ran toward the Rosewood office. He dodged desks like a football player. As he got to the office door, it opened. A crowd came out. Chief Morrison, Finlay, and Baker, holding Hubble by the elbow. A light but efficient grip, the same as he had used on me. Stevenson stared blankly at Hubble, and then grabbed Finlay by the arm, pulled him back into the office. Morrison swiveled his sweating bulk and followed them in. The door slammed. Baker walked Hubble over toward me. Hubble looked like a different guy. He was gray and sweating. The tan had gone. He looked smaller. He looked like someone had let the air out and deflated him. He was bent up like a man racked with pain. His eyes behind the gold rims were blank and staring with panic and fear. He stood shaking as Baker unlocked the cell next to mine. He didn't move. He was trembling. Baker caught his arm and levered him inside. He pulled the gate shut and locked it. The electric bolts snicked in. Baker walked back toward the Rosewood office. Hubble just stood where Baker had left him, staring blankly into space. Then he slowly walked backward until he reached the rear wall of the cell. He pressed his back against it and slid to the floor, dropped his head to his knees, dropped his hands to the floor. I could hear the rattle of his thumb trembling on the stiff nylon carpet. Roscoe stared in at him from her desk. The sergeant at the reception counter gazed across. They were watching a man fall apart. I heard raised voices in the Rosewood office in back, the tenor of argument, the slap of a palm on a desk. The door opened and Stevenson walked out with Chief Morrison. Stevenson looked mad. He strode down the side of the open area. His neck was rigid with fury. His eyes were fixed on the front doors. He was ignoring the fat police chief. He walked straight past the reception counter and out through the heavy door into the bright afternoon. Morrison followed him. Baker came out of the office and walked over to my cell. Didn't speak, just unlocked the cage and gestured me out. I shrugged my coat tighter and left the newspaper with the big photographs of the president in Pensacola on the cell floor. Stepped out and followed Baker back into the Rosewood office. Finlay was at the desk. The tape recorder was there. The stiff cords trailed. The air was still and cool. Finlay looked harassed. His tie was pulled down. He blew out a big lungful of air in a rueful hiss. I sat down in the chair, and Finlay waved Baker out of the room. The door closed softly behind him. "We got us a situation here, Mr. Reacher," Finlay said. "A real situation." He lapsed into a distracted silence. I had less than a half hour before the prison bus came by. I wanted some conclusions pretty soon. Finlay looked up and focused again, started talking rapidly, the elegant Harvard syntax under pressure. "We bring this Hubble guy in, right?" he said. "You maybe saw him? Banker from Atlanta, right? $1,000 Calvin Klein outfit, gold Rolex. Very uptight guy." At first, I thought he was just annoyed. Soon as I started talking, he recognized my voice from the phone call on his mobile. Accuses me of deceitful behavior. Says I shouldn't impersonate phone company people. He's right, of course. Another lapse into silence. He was struggling with his ethics problem. "Come on, Finlay, move along," I said. I had less than a half hour. "Okay, so he's uptight and annoyed," Finlay said. "I ask him if he knows you, Jack Reacher, ex-army. He says, no, never heard of you. I believe him. He starts to relax, like all this is about some guy called Jack Reacher. He's never heard of any guy called Jack Reacher, so he's here for nothing. He's cool, right?" "Go on," I said. "Then I ask him if he knows a tall guy with a shaved head," he said. "And I ask him about pluribus." Well, my God. It's like I stuck a poker up his ass. He went rigid, like with shock. Totally rigid. Won't answer. So I tell him, we know the tall guy is dead. Shot to death. Well, that's like another poker up the ass. He practically fell off the chair. "Go on," I said, 25 minutes before the prison bus was due. "He's shaking all over the place," Finlay said. "Then I tell him we know about the phone number in the shoe. His phone number, printed on a piece of paper with the word pluribus printed above it. That's another poker up the ass." He stopped again. He was patting his pockets, each one in turn. "He wouldn't say anything," he went on. "Not a word. He was rigid with shock, all gray in the face. I thought he was having a heart attack.